So, most of you have heard the previous lectures in this series. Let me just briefly summarize our basic idea. We're talking about scattering theory in Minkowski space, and we really build a set of quantum systems that correspond to time-like trajectories in Minkowski space, and we talk about scattering as viewed along those time-like trajectories. The way that works out is that for any given time-like trajectory, any finite length of time, there's a finite causal diamond. You take a longer length of time, there are bigger causal diamonds. Those correspond to a nested tensor factorization of the Hilbert space, which is expressed in terms of a set of variables psi ia, which are, if the causal diamond has size n in Planck units, where size means the square root of the radius, and I'm not putting in constants, then these variables are n times n plus 1 matrices, and out of them we build matrices M, which are psi IA, psi dagger, AJ. Those are n by n matrices. And the crucial realization that I think is the most important thing in our story of how black hole mechanics works is that initial states in scattering are defined by special states of these matrices in the limit of very large n, in which of order n matrix elements are set equal to zero, and the square matrices M are block diagonal. These, in a well-known way, these are can be thought of as spinner functions on the two-dimensional sphere. That two-dimensional sphere is the holographic screen. Holographic screen for us means the maximum area surface, not its history, as it does for Raphael and his collaborators. And these variables describe functions, but with an angular momentum cutoff. When I'm thinking about functions on the sphere, the constraints that I'm talking about are saying that there are some localized regions on the sphere out at infinity, and little annuli around each of those localized regions. These correspond to these smaller blocks. The zeros around here are the zeros that you see in the off diagonal. That comes from the relationship between, if I have a function here and a function here, their product is zero. So in matrices, that comes by making a block diagonal construction. And this large block of the matrices corresponds to everything else that's outside of those annuli. And as n goes to infinity, it represents degrees of freedom that are carrying zero momentum out through any finite area on the sphere.
So, Tom, just to be clear, it's an n by n matrix? Or
this is an n by n matrix.
By n. And the square root of n there is just means the size of that block or something?
It's the square root of the whole thing. So n is the size of the whole big block.
There's n squared elements of the matrix?
Yes.
Okay.
This is just the standard of scaling.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, you're just multiplying that matrix
by 1
over square root of
n. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry. Just to clarify that last statement, you said that most of the degrees of freedom correspond to things that, as the sphere gets very large, carry negligible momentum through any finite piece of the area? But they still carry, therefore, substantial energy over, out through the whole sphere?
They're carrying an arbitrarily small amount of energy out through the whole sphere.
Okay.
In the limit.
Okay.
So the finite energy in the end, the actual scattering limit is a complicated one. You will not get Lorentz invariant scattering amplitudes. We don't know how to get them yet at all, but it's clear you will not get them unless you can first take n to infinity. That corresponds to taking the proper time to infinity and doing scattering, and then taking the ki's to infinity afterwards. Or perhaps in some correlated way where ki behaves as a certain power, then we have not figured that out yet because we don't yet know what the how to precisely implement the constraints of Lorentz invariants. There's a huge class of models here. These models are characterized by a polynomial of some finite order. In these matrices, the scaling is 1 power of n down from a Tuft scaling. And that leads to a lack of interaction as n goes to infinity. If I stick this Hamiltonian, if I stick this into the Hamiltonian with this matrix M, basically everything just becomes this piece over here. And this piece over here just gives me the trace of the matrix to leading order as k goes to infinity. And so that's measuring what I called the energy last time. And I showed you that the sum of the sizes of these k blocks was conserved in this scattering for any one of these Hamiltonians. And that's basically because this is of order n constraints. And because it's a finite polynomial and the explicit 1 over n in front, you can't loosen of order n of those constraints. You can at most change of order 1 of the constraints from initial to final state. So the final states will also look block diagonal like this, with small blocks. The way the blocks are arranged will be different, but the total sum of the k's will be preserved.
So Tom,
yep.
Can you just comment on, so usually when I think of a Hamiltonian in a gravitational system, there's some boundary.
Yes, so this is very explicitly not that.
Yeah.
So what we're doing here is we're describing what's going on locally by choosing a gauge. We're actually choosing many, many, many different gauges, each of which is tied to a particular time-like trajectory in space-time. And these are the Hamiltonians that describe causal propagation along those trajectories. The Hamiltonian always has a breakup into h in of t plus h out of t. It's not a time-independent Hamiltonian. Energy conservation comes out as an asymptotic boundary property, as I just tried to recall the argument. The Hamiltonian Hn acts only on degrees of freedom associated with the causal diamond between minus t, minus 1, and minus t, or correspondingly also in the future. There is a time symmetry here. It's more complicated, I've realized, than what I said last time. It's just not h of minus t equals h of t. You have to talk about what the initial and final states are. So I'm writing a form of the Hamiltonian that's appropriate for certain initial and final states.
Have you completely specified the gauge though? I mean, I understand that you have one clock from the proper time along.
Yeah, I've completely, right.
But that's only one clock. I mean, and right, so you know, then that doesn't give you a global.
No, what it does is it specifies the gauge completely inside the causal diamond.
You have to say how you extend that time coordinate away from the world line.
The time coordinate is extended by this construction. Okay, the nesting of the causal diamonds gives me a set of hyperbolic slices of
the
space-time.
The slices come from the corners of the diamonds?
That's right. Yeah. Okay, they don't cover all of space-time, they only cover the interior of the diamond at any given time. What happens as time goes to infinity, h in takes up everything, h out ends up not depending on anything. But at any given finite time, there's a piece of the system which is not described causally along this particular trajectory. And the way we deal with that is we introduce an infinite number of other quantum mechanical systems corresponding to all the other time-like trajectories. We do the same thing for each of them, and H out and the initial state in the out part of the Hilbert space is matched by insisting that all these different systems give compatible density matrices on all possible overlaps of pairs of causal boundaries.
So the H of T without the inner out is defined with respect to a fixed diamond.
Yes.
Right?
No, with respect to a fixed trajectory.
Yeah, which defines a fixed diamond.
Fixed set of diamonds.
But the trajectory...
The trajectory and a proper time length defines a fixed set of diamonds. I also have to pick a point of time symmetry.
What's the Hilbert space that H of T acts on? I mean,
H of T acts on the entire Hilbert space of the system.
It's the biggest diamond?
The biggest diamond that you ever get to.
Yeah.
So then, in De Sitter space, that would be a finite dimensional space of states. In Minkowski space, it's infinite dimensional. And so on.
And then this decomposition into in and out, though, is based on smaller diamonds?
That's right. So the decomposition into in and out is time dependent. At any given time along the trajectory, the causal diamond has a fixed size. That tells you how to split up the variables as far as counting, and how to split up the variables as far as organizing. That's done by specifying what the initial state is. And then in the initial state, all of the incoming particles are included. But as time goes on in a smaller diamond, some of those particles will simply not be seen by this particular trajectory in its small diamond.
But in and out don't necessarily act on separate tensor factors in the Hilbert space, right?
Or they do.
But they do. There's not coupling between them?
There's no coupling between them whatsoever, ever.
So
what happens is that you take these variables,
yeah,
the fermions for the largest causal diamond, you take a subset of them, which corresponds to those that belong to this small causal diamond along this trajectory.
Yeah.
You make that subset by making an angular momentum decomposition with respect to the particular SO3 that keeps that trajectory invariant. Okay, the one that, you know, the one of your celestial sphere.
Yeah.
And that'll be a different decomposition for different diamonds. And then if in a picture of Minkowski space-time, two diamonds overlap, there's a maximal diamond in their intersection, the rules of quantum mechanics say that that should correspond to some tensor factor in each of these two Hilbert spaces, and the two density matrices have to have the same modular Hamiltonian or modular eigenvector.
Should there be interactions at the corners?
Sorry?
Should there be interactions at the corners?
Those interactions are taken into account by this compatibility condition. So these different systems have no interaction whatsoever.
So I shouldn't think of them as roughly being like sort of the thing.
Everything here is discrete. The diamonds grow by discrete amounts by adding an integer number of these fermionic variables.
Yeah, but if we just fix the diamond, then
yes,
shouldn't there be entanglement between sort of the inside of the diamond and the outside?
The state might be entangled. The Hamiltonian doesn't have to be.
But
this is not quantum field theory. It's discrete.
Yeah, well, I understand it's not quantum.
So you don't have to do that.
Yeah, but I mean, so for example, if I studied the state that was the thermal density matrix, e to the minus h.
On the whole thing?
Yeah.
Well, there's no h here, really.
Well, that would be a product state, then, between the inner and the outer parts of the diamonds.
Right? I'm not sure what you mean by it. You mean e to the minus h of t at some particular t? Yeah, that would be a product state.
Yeah, that's those words.
What? There's no significance, I think, to h out of t,
mm-hmm,
okay, except the significance that's lent to it by its overlap conditions with other trajectories. OK? Okay. So, now, one of the reasons I wanted to emphasize all of this, I explained last time how when I look at the dynamics that's generated by a Hamiltonian like this, there are sort of two choices of what can happen in some small causal diamond. At some time t, depending on what one says about how the initial state is configured and how the incoming particles enter into that diamond. If the incoming particles are such that the number of particle degrees of freedom always remains small compared to the number of total degrees of freedom down to some tiny size of order a few Planck lengths, then what the evolution of this system corresponds to, I argued, was that you'll come in with some set of constraints, go out of the diamond of some size of order not too many Planck lengths with a different set of constraints, and that'll correspond to a particle vertex where some number of particles came in, some number of particles came out. And then by stringing that together with the consistency conditions between different trajectories, so suppose there's a diamond where something like that happened. Here's a diamond where some number of particles came in, some number of particles came out. Translation into the language of actual creation and annihilation operators, there was some set of constraints on the initial state that made a block diagonal matrix like this. There's some set of constraints on the final state that makes a similar block diagonal matrix. That's represented by a picture like this. That happened. Let me pick a trajectory that goes through that particular diamond where this event happened. There might be another trajectory that went through a diamond where some other set of particles came in, and it could be that one of these particles incoming came from the outgoing particles over here. Okay? So this is a very complicated set of Hamiltonians, but all they are set up to be compatible with each other. And the way we make them compatible, at least for trajectories that are very far separated, is the same way we do it in quantum field theory. We take inside of the Hilbert space on which H out acts, we say, oh gosh, I need to have something that's compatible with what the H in of this trajectory is seeing over here. And so in H out of this system down here, we put a copy of the dynamics and the initial state that we see over there. Okay? So this is what determines, we believe, H out to a large extent. And the real determination, you have to use not just trajectories that are at relative rest, but also trajectories that have relative velocity with respect to each other. We don't yet understand how to impose those constraints. And we believe that they will be very strong because that's the constraint of Lorentz invariance of the S matrix. And we know, for example, from string theory, that we can write down a lot of good Hamiltonian theories that look like they're theories of gravity, except they don't give Lorentz invariant S matrices. So
by that you meant like the non-critical string or something?
For example, or strings with, you know, tachyons. C less than 10. No, tachyons don't make any sense at all. There's no S matrix.
Yeah.
But if C is less than 10 and you work in light cone gauge,
yeah,
then the S matrix exists. It's unitary, but it's not Lorentz invariant.
Bosonic.
Superstring
with, you just mean the subcritical.
I mean the superstring with the wrong number of dimensions.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. So there's a conformal anomaly and so on, and we can't go between the... Okay. So one of the things that this formalism guarantees is that all interactions are local. Everything is unitary, manifestly. And it has this version of general covariance in it, namely this statement that physics has seen along different time-like trajectories, whenever it's comparable between two trajectories, gives you the same answer up to a change of basis in your Hilbert space. Okay, so now what's the other thing that can happen besides these particles coming in? Well, it could be that the amount of energy that you try to put in, the size of these blocks that I try to put into the causal diamond of size n, is such that I don't have many more constraints than I have blocks, okay? So I don't have this large reservoir of degrees of freedom. And in that case, the argument that the system just, you know, ends up with of order n constraints, well, it doesn't have of order n constraints to begin with, and so the system will, if the Hamiltonian is chosen to be a fast scrambler, and Susskind and Sacchino have conjectured that essentially all Hamiltonians of this matrix form are fast scramblers, the system will scramble itself. And so you'll get an equilibrium state, which I claim is extremely metastable, because the way that it will decay is that it'll have to wait. So I have now some large block. All of the matrix elements are turned on. The states no longer have a particle interpretation. They have to be thought of as just living on the horizon, because there isn't this way of following the constraints in that makes them into local degrees of freedom. And that the system then qualitatively has all the properties we expect of a black hole. In particular, in order to get back to a situation with constraints, you have to ask, how probable is it to have n constraints on a system of n squared variables? And you find that it goes like, if it's n times e constraints, it goes like e to the minus e times n, and that's the right qualitative scaling of the thermal behavior of a black hole. So these systems will emit particles in a thermal manner and will decay slowly if they're large enough.
Could you say more what you mean by constraints exactly?
Yeah. The constraints are that these are operators. So every matrix element of this matrix is an operator in my Hilbert space.
And
a constraint means
with eigenvalues 0 and 1 or something.
It's, for example, yeah, it's more complicated than that because I have a lot of fermions. And so these M's are matrices in the different fermions.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Okay. So my constraint in terms of the fermions is complicated, but what it's basically saying is that of order n fermions is set equal to zero. Okay?
So you're thinking of that as a constraint on the state.
On
so
the
when
state.
This operator acts on that state.
Right. So this I wrote this as if it looks like an operator identity, but it's not. This is just a way of specifying what the initial state is, that the operator m acting on the initial state looks like this. Okay? So there are definitely, in systems of this type, there are two kinds of states.
Sorry, can I ask one more question?
Yes.
You're talking about particles, but I realize I don't even understand what the no particle state is. Can
there is no
can
such
you describe
state.
The vacuum?
The no particle state is the state where, at infinity, there are no constraints. So it's a generic state of the variables. This fits with something else we know, namely if we're not talking about Minkowski space, but about De Sitter space, then we believe that the empty De Sitter vacuum is the state of maximal entropy, and That's what I would be describing in that case. The difference between the two is that we expect, and this is something I believe may require Lorentz invariants to really occur, we expect this huge set of degrees of freedom that to actually decouple in the Minkowski case in the limit n goes to infinity. And thinking of those degrees of freedom as very low energy gravitons, the arguments for that that we know in standard S matrix theory involve Lorentz invariants.
And decouple means completely decouple?
Yeah.
So I can just ignore them for...
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, this is this weird fact that the entropy of Minkowski space is infinite if you approach it from the De Sitter space.
So the idea is that in Minkowski space, incoming particles are constrained states. Outgoing particles should be constrained states. If that's very hard to think about when I'm thinking about the infinite dimensional algebras of variables at infinity, the matrix formulation of this in finite causal diamonds makes it very precise. There's a finite number of degrees of freedom. These are going to be interpreted as particles at infinity, most of them not. And those that are not are definitely given zero energy by my Hamiltonian, but they also had better decouple, because otherwise the S matrix won't be unitary on the particle subspace.
So the S matrix is unitary on the particle subspace.
Right.
Okay.
But this has, I mean, does this have something to do with the fact that in, you know, you always have gravitons here, so in Minkowski space, you know, the S matrix isn't that well defined because the vacuum isn't
Something that you weren't here for. The first lecture I gave here, I gave a whole lecture about how I don't think thinking about Fock space is the right way to think about asymptotic infinity in theories of gravity. You actually have to think about a current algebra that describes flows of currents through the boundary. And these variables were precisely that.
Yeah.
See you later. Okay. So now that Don has left, I can talk about black holes. So what I claim is we have models of something that looks a lot like black holes. These are explicit models. They are not, almost all of them are not a correct model of quantum gravity because they won't have Lorentz invariant S matrices. But they have a lot of the qualitative features that we'd expect in such a theory of quantum gravity. So I want to talk about in this model, just one second, Daniel. I'd like to talk in this model about how I think about the evolution of a black hole and questions like the Amps paradox.
Yeah.
Okay?
So I just have a question about what you said before, sorry.
Yes.
So in higher dimensions, infrared divergences get better.
Yeah, the issue is not really infrared divergences. Yeah. But that in any number of dimensions, the probability to emit in any scattering amplitude an arbitrarily large number of very low energy gravitons in all kinds of directions is non-zero.
Yeah, but doesn't that usually show up via infrared divergences?
No. Shows up by infrared divergences is in four dimensions, any process in which you don't emit an infinite number of gravitons has zero probability.
Yeah, yeah, right.
That's not true in higher dimensions, at least sufficiently high, but it's still true that these processes where I emit, you can just draw the Feynman diagram.
Right.
They have finite probabilities to describe a unitary scattering matrix. You just can't describe just single particle states, because any process is going to have some probability to produce these things and some probability that those things were incoming, because you can't distinguish an initial state with one graviton of certain momentum from an initial state of one graviton of that momentum and 50,000 gravitons of momentum less than epsilon.
Right.
Okay. So I think that's the issue, and I think that's dimension independent. Okay. So the way that we think about black holes is to try to put completely out of our minds this picture, okay? Because in actual fact, we all know that once we take quantum mechanics into account in Minkowski space, that picture is wrong, all right? What happens in Minkowski space is I scatter particles, I create a black hole out of particle states. I just showed you a way in these models in which that happens. And then that black hole decays back into particles, okay? And it does it because it's a finite entropy system, and the set of all possible particles in infinite Minkowski space has much more entropy, and all the conservation laws are allowed. So just thermodynamically, it has to decay. So the right way to think completely quantum mechanically about a black hole, I would claim, is to think in Minkowski space and to think about a time-like cylinder of finite extent. This is sort of the history of the stretched horizon of the black hole from the moment the black hole is created until the black hole finishes evaporating. Okay? And I can then talk about trajectories in Minkowski space that, let's take a very particular black hole. I take two very high energy gravitons, I collide them, work in the center of mass, I create a black hole at rest in a particular place in space. I can think about the Minkowski geodesic that went through the place where that event will have occurred, okay? By the way, one other thing I want to emphasize about this formalism, which is directly connected to what we've just been saying about jets of particles, the trajectories of particles in this kind of theory with infrared, not divergences, but infrared issues, are actually much more well-defined than they are in standard S-matrix theory. Because every particle comes along with a jet of an arbitrarily large number of soft particles. And so that set of states is large enough for some aspects of it, namely the trajectory, to sort of decohere. In this formalism, it's even more striking than that, because I've defined the particle trajectories in terms of constraints on a much larger set of variables, okay? Constraints that I've told you can't quantum fluctuate away, okay? And so it's my contention that I can really think very particularly, given the asymptotic initial conditions, about the place where the black hole is going to appear. And I don't have to worry about, oh, maybe there's some quantum probability that it appeared someplace else. Okay?
By the place, you mean basically where the particles...
Yeah, I send in two particles.
Zero impact parameter.
I say what their impact parameter is in terms of asymptotic data, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, we know in the Eichenholz approximation exactly how to do that. And what I'd really like to claim is that basically, for that purpose, the infrared gravitons make that aspect of the Eichenholz approximation much more exact than it would be in some theory of massive particles in QCD or something.
Tom, they better not decohere the coherent quantum effects that we already observed. I mean, particles can be in superpositions of different...
Oh, absolutely.
Paths.
Absolutely. There's no contradiction with that here. There's absolutely no. Okay. Let me be more careful about what I said. What I really mean is, if it is indeed true that the Feynman diagram parts of this of the amplitudes in this thing can be made by tuning parameters into real Feynman diagrams, then we know that. So in other words, there's a scattering matrix here. It's quasi-local. It's unitary. If it's Lorentz invariant, we know it has to be described by the standard Feynman diagrams at low energy. That's what we've tested. Okay. So,
Tom, I mean, I know you don't want to talk about that picture, but...
Well, I was about to actually say something about that picture, but...
Well, I guess I was just curious if you could... I was curious if you could draw the diamonds you're talking about in the picture.
It depends which trajectory I'm talking about. I'm going to talk about several different trajectories.
Well, okay, fine.
Okay? So one of them is, if I take this trajectory here, there's a set of diamonds, you know, depending on where I take its midpoint, the point of its smallest diamond, there's a set of diamonds that goes like this for that trajectory. Okay? Then some other trajectory that goes over here, there will be a corresponding set of nested diamonds and so on and so forth. Now, of course it doesn't go here, it goes back to here. But, because these are all time-like trajectories. How am I actually supposed to think about this picture? So again, my guide here is sitting in the seat next to you. I believe that what Ted taught us about gravity is that the space-time metrical pictures should be thought of as hydrodynamic approximations to the behavior of quantum systems that obey the area law. We have, in our formalism, a position for space-time that goes beyond that. Namely, we have built up the quantum theory based on all of these causal diamonds and trajectories and so on. But those are trajectories in a fixed background space-time. Minkowski space, in this case, we were doing ADS and I knew how to do error correcting codes, I might be able to tell you how to do this in ADS space. The space-time geometry doesn't get changed by doing some process. What's happening is some quantum state is being created, and the local hydrodynamic flows in that quantum state are different than they are in the almost empty Minkowski vacuum. And so it is convenient to summarize coarse-grained features for a finite amount of time of what's actually happening with a picture like this that shows distorted geometry. To give you a trivial example of things that we actually know, when we do a computation in string theory of this process of scattering particles that might or might not create a black hole, there's an entire kinematic regime where we believe that we have essentially resummed the string perturbation theory to leading order. This is the Eichenholz regime, and in string theory you can go a little bit further in from the Eichenholz regime because you have this other length scale. And we can do calculations that we believe give us the correct behavior in a certain energy regime of the exact S matrix. Those calculations never mention a black hole. They always do string theory diagrams in Minkowski space. They get into regions where we suspect, if we try to push those calculations, we suspect black holes are formed. We have examples of Michael Duff's computation that show us how, as an approximation to those diagrams, we would see classical solutions. But we don't have to, even though it's beautiful, even though, you know, it gives a lot of wonderful correct physics, we do not have to have this picture in the exact description. Okay? So I'm going to be describing things in a way that try to reproduce aspects of that picture, but not all of them. And one of the major things that I don't like about this picture is this thing up here.
Before you go into that, I guess there's a tension here, which I think I've maybe asked about before. But you know, on the one hand, gravity is hydrodynamics. That's
yes.
Message number two, actually.
Right.
But message number one was that I have gravitons, propagating gravitons.
Those two things have no contradiction with each other. Because if I take a condensed matter system near its ground state and look at low energy excitations of it, it's described by quantized hydrodynamic waves. And there are Feynman diagrams involving phonons and their interactions with other kinds of quasi-particles. And there's nothing that says from that that the underlying theory is quantized hydrodynamics, and you know it isn't.
But there's some tension because, for example, the gravitons, before you say anything about hydrodynamics, the gravitons obey something like if you've got the right S matrix, they obey something like the linearized Einstein's equations or order by order Einstein's equations,
sure.
Et cetera. And that's before you said the word hydrodynamics. So in other words, it looks like the equations that would be hydrodynamics.
Paper you read first. If you read Ted's paper before you read anything else, you hear hydrodynamics before you hear Einstein's equations.
Well, no, I'm just saying the way you've set up the formalism, if you're really, you've got, some Hamiltonian that in the end is going to give you the
fact
that's
because, matrix, that's, say, because you know, that's because I'm studying a problem, which is Minkowski space. Mm-hmm. What we think we know about Minkowski space from string theory is that it's a system with a unique ground state, and we know how to calculate the interactions between small fluctuations around that ground state.
Right.
In a certain kinematic regime.
And basically those they're associated with Einstein's equations in their own way. It's the perturbative expansion of the Einstein.
You know as well as I do, Steve, that the way that we actually got to those equations in string theory was not by deriving them as equations, but by calculating scattering amplitudes and taking limits and saying, oh, look, I can reproduce this in this limit by effective field theory.
Yeah.
We've both suffered through string field theory, which was an attempt to make more out of that observation than was in it, and it was a disaster.
Yeah. No, but the essence of, one way of saying, maybe not the essence, but one way of saying what's bothering me is that, your Hamiltonian already contains Einstein's equations in some, slightly harder to recognize form, but basically Einstein's equations, because it governs the scattering, the low energy scattering, say, of gravitons. But on the other hand, you're saying Einstein's equations come out of hydrodynamics,
I would claim there's no more tension there than there is between the fact that I can describe the low temperature properties of a solid in terms of the behavior of free phonons and then interaction corrections with Feynman diagrams involving phonons, and the fact that actually the quantum degrees of freedom of a solid have nothing to do with phonons, and that the phonon equations, the hydrodynamic equations as classical equations, come out in much more general circumstances for very high entropy states where the approximation of phonons as quantum particles is just wrong.
Well, sorry, so maybe I'm misunderstanding, but so in ADS-CFT, Einstein's equation and some approximation holds in the bulk. And we certainly don't worry about the fact that the Lagrangian of the CFT doesn't look anything like the Einstein-Hilbert action.
Einstein's equation holds in the bulk as a quantum equation for computing Feynman-Witten diagrams.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's, that's sort
of... The other kinds of use of Einstein's equations where I compute non-trivial solutions is something else entirely, okay? And there are different non-trivial, non-linear classical solutions in ADS that represent different phenomena.
That's right, but so this is this thing we were fighting about maybe earlier this week and when I was here before about how, that you can sum up, you can construct things around the vacuum and then you can do this Duff kind of thing where you can just start in the other background. And either way, you're going to get the right answer, right?
Well, the statement you can start it in any other background is just not correct.
There are some limitations having to do
with there are certain backgrounds that correspond to putting in things with the wrong boundary conditions to describe a state in the CFT.
Oh, well, that's
and then it describes a different theory.
Oh, no, but you wouldn't even start to think about
okay,
that.
So fine, I don't start
that's
to
not
think
in the theory
that.
At all.
Then there's another background which is called the thermofield double, the ABF Schwarzschild black hole, which, certain of our colleagues want to totally reject as having anything to do with the actual behavior of the thermal state. But,
I don't know. I would say when you're doing quantum gravity, you first fix the boundary conditions and then the boundaries and so on, and then you discuss the states.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
Can I ask for clarification on, so it's hit me now, really, you really mean there's a fixed Minkowski metric?
Absolutely.
Now, this N, that was chosen for a given diamond, there's a certain area of the bounding surface, and N is related to that area, right?
Okay. So
is that right?
That's true in the limit of large diamonds.
Large
compared to the Planck scale.
Okay, fine. Let's stick to that. But now, so what I'm puzzled by is that area I'm measuring in this fixed Minkowski metric.
Right.
But now we can have, of course, a situation where we have some deformation of Minkowski. The most extreme one that we've lived through, so to speak, is, let's say, inflation. So the scale of the area in the underlying Minkowski metric that you're saying is some part of this theory has nothing to do with the scale of the area and the actual physical.
Our theory of inflation is very different from what I'm putting on the board. Taking a fixed Minkowski background is something that's appropriate only if I'm doing scattering theory in Minkowski space. The theory of inflation is a different quantum mechanical model. Not the same model.
Let's take a scattering that forms a black hole then. All I'm trying to say is that the
scattering that
what we call the
physical
hole. Metric can differ a lot from the underlying Minkowski one.
Yes, I agree
one.
With that.
And I'm still using the underlying Minkowski one.
Wait. What I'm using is a quantum mechanics that was motivated by the underlying Minkowski metric. When the black hole is formed, okay, all that I want to say about that black hole is that it has a certain entropy, okay? And that's a quantum mechanical concept, all right? And I will say that if that black hole is isolated from the rest of the world for a long time, I can relate that entropy to properties of an effective metric. And those properties, I was going to try to discuss that in just a minute with this picture, okay? So I want to try to talk, since there's not too much time, I want to try to reserve your question for part three and talk about the experience along a variety of trajectories that one might encounter in the black hole situation and try to relate it to aspects of this picture. And as I said, the part of this picture that bothers me the most is the singularity, the part where we all agree we don't know what's going on, but many of us imagine that we somehow have to stop the evolution at this point. The picture I've given you of the creation of black holes in this matrix model, obviously, that's not what happens. If I take a trajectory which goes through the region where a black hole forms, all that happens is there's an equilibrium state with a large entropy that gets created, and that equilibrium state has no notion of space-time associated with it inside of that subset of degrees of freedom, okay? That subset of degrees of freedom corresponds to a tensor factor in the Hilbert space, so I would tend to say there's some set of causal diamonds which are associated with that subset of the Hilbert space. All I want to say for sure is that someplace on the order of the Schwarzschild radius, which is the radius associated with this entropy, that picture should coincide with conclusions that I make from this picture over here for coarse grain quantities. Okay? So an example of a coarse grain quantity, of course, is the temperature. I tried to argue for you that that was going to come out at least parametrically correct. But something else that will come out correct, at least to leading order, I don't know how to prove this more to higher order in an expansion in powers of the Schwarzschild radius, we've demonstrated, and I haven't done that in these lectures, that the interactions of this Hamiltonian lead to large impact parameter scattering of things that agrees parametrically in energy and impact parameter with what you expect from the standard Feynman diagram picture of the Eichenholz approximation. The consequence of that is that if I think about this cylinder in Minkowski space and I think about a trajectory that goes, is just a Minkowski trajectory that goes up here, and now that's just a mathematical trajectory in Minkowski space. But now if I think about an actual particle, okay, if I had that particle starting out along this trajectory at very early times before the black hole was formed, it could follow along the trajectory. But because there is a big scattering matrix between that particle and the black hole, there's no way that I can think of the scattering of this particle as keeping the particle on that trajectory. So there's a background Minkowski geometry, but the things I call particle excitations do not propagate on that background geometry. They follow curved paths. And if I want to escape that influence, then I have to accelerate. I have to be moving with respect to the black hole on an accelerated trajectory such that I'm always getting far enough away so that it, so that this attractive interaction that exists will not pull me in.
So how does this interaction manifest? Like the interaction between the black hole and the other trajectory?
Yeah, so I haven't actually lectured about that, but if you look in this kind of a Hamiltonian, a very large impact parameter, there, if the polynomial has high enough order, there are terms that involve the product of this block, the product of that block, and the product of this block. And if this block is in a generic state, you average over all of its states, that gives an interaction between these two blocks that's proportional to the size of their, what I call their energies, the product of the sizes of their energies, and has the right scaling with the impact parameter to be Newton's law or the generalization of Newton's law for relativistic particles at large impact parameter. We do not get the right kinematic factors to give a Lorentz invariant scattering amplitude. We just get the right scaling for this generic class of models.
So you're getting all interactions? I mean, you have to get attractive gravity and two signs of charge for charge interactions. And
the model I've told you about so far, where these things are just fermions, doesn't have any charged particles in it.
So it's pure gravity.
It's pure n equals 8 supergravity, on a, which is M theory compactified on a torus of order the Planck scale. Okay, so there are the charged black holes are extremely massive. They're black holes. There may be, I don't know how to describe the minimally charged particles, the Kaluza-Klein excitations, but there are more than one or two of those. So there are issues precisely like what you've said about how I get all the other interactions. We don't understand how that's come out.
It's not even clear to me that you would get attracted, that there be a definite sign in the interaction.
Absolutely not. So that's a constraint on this. That's a constraint on this polynomial in order that this set of models actually give rise to. We don't as yet see any principle in the models that guarantees that that interaction is attractive, because it seems like it can come from various terms in the polynomial. And then if I give them random coefficients, I don't think the sign will be right. So that's an additional constraint. And I've assumed I've imposed that constraint in the discussion that I just gave. So as I said, most of these models are not good models of quantum gravity. They just have certain correct behaviors.
Wait, on this picture, so I also don't like the Penrose diagram. I like this kind of picture better. But if I have a trajectory that goes into the black hole and then does something, do you have a nice sort of set of nested diamonds for that that you can...
Yeah, because, look, if we imagine thinking about this trajectory long after the black hole has evaporated, mm-hmm. It's clear there's a set of diamonds. It goes up there, okay?
Good, yeah.
And there's a set of diamonds that goes down here.
Good.
And, you know, the quantum mechanics of the model describes what I can call a set of diamonds in this picture, whether or not there's a decent geometrical picture of those diamonds. Right? The quantum mechanics of the model separates out subsets of degrees of freedom which commute with all the rest, and says their dynamics is going to behave this way and be decoupled from the rest for a long time. Mm-hmm. Okay?
So do you think that, so if I have, again, a trajectory of, say, a particle that I'm thinking of as falling into the black hole and then, you know, gets to the center and
right.
Et cetera, et cetera.
So you saw what actually happened to that particle. What actually happened to that particle was that all of these off-diagonal degrees of freedom, which were turned off and didn't allow that particle to interact with most of the degrees of freedom in the diamond, get turned on when I get to more energy than is allowed within a Schwarzschild radius. When that happens, I just have this big block. There are no particles anymore. There's no way that I can talk about local trajectories by following the constraints into smaller and smaller diamonds. It's just a mess, but there's quantum mechanics. And that quantum mechanics defines a time evolution. And then I argued that if you wait long enough, that time evolution does lead to the emission of some of these particles. Okay. And in a much larger causal diamond, and that will eventually lead to the decay of the metastable state. In the model, in the quantum mechanics of the model, there will be a metastable state that forms and decays thermally. Okay? So that allows me to draw a trajectory right up the middle of the singularity and out the other side. Okay. Nothing to do with the interior Schwarzschild geometry in the region of the singularity. Okay, I don't know if I'm going to get a chance to tell you about our story at the beginning of the story of what that interior geometry has to do with, but I want to at least tell you about the part of the interior geometry that is under debate ever since the paper that Don and his collaborators wrote. Okay. And the way I want to do that is to think about two different trajectories, okay, which enter into this black hole region. And, well, one enters in, and one enters in, but only after the black hole has disappeared, if you will, okay? So the those two trajectories, in a very loose way, and in our paper we were not sufficiently insistent on how loose this association was, I want to think of loosely as associated with trajectories in the actual Schwarzschild method, okay? So here's a set of trajectories I want to talk about in the Schwarzschild metric. They're the trajectories that lead you to build Novikov coordinates. You take particles at rest, massive particles at rest, and you drop them in from a certain radius. You build a synchronous gauge. You synchronize their proper times. The metric looks like minus d tau squared, plus a time-dependent spatial metric.
Is it the same as rain coordinates?
What?
Rain coordinates?
Rain coordinates?
No, I don't think so.
I thought that was, that's the thing where you drop dust. Sort of.
Okay. You look in Misner, Thorne, and Wheeler.
Yeah.
Look up Novikov coordinates. There's formulas.
Yeah.
Up the wazoo for what these things are.
This is geodesic normal. They're black holes?
Yeah, these are not null coordinates. These are time-like trajectories. They're geodesics that fall in from a certain height. They reach the black hole at a certain time.
Yeah.
Okay. And so now I can think about those, loosely those things, which in my picture are just going to be these time-like Minkowski geodesics, okay, that go through this black hole at different times, okay? Now, what happens along those trajectories in the quantum mechanical model, okay? And now what I want to do is, in addition, these trajectories are just mathematics. There aren't actually systems associated with these trajectories. I just told you a little while ago about how certain of these trajectories won't be followed by particles. They're just a set of coordinates on this picture, okay? But those coordinates correspond to particular quantum mechanical systems, okay? And so what I want to do with those coordinates is to think about what happens as something actually approaches the black hole. So now I'm going to take an actual physical system and have it approach the black hole as viewed from different coordinate system, different trajectories in my coordinate system. So what that corresponds to is just some collection of particles, because what I mean by a system is what we all think of as a system, something that we can, roughly speaking, talk about as being built up out of a bunch of particles. I actually want them to be massive. I haven't actually told you how to talk about massive particles. Let's leave that aside. The main point is there's a certain time along the trajectory where the particle is some distance away from the black hole, in which I can assume that the initial state of its variables look like this. Okay. As it starts to interact with the black hole, these degrees of freedom get turned on, and the system comes into equilibrium. Okay. The time scale for that, given the explicit 1 over n in front of this, the Atuft scaling of the rest of it, and the fast scrambler hypothesis of Sacchino and Susskind, the time for that equilibration is the time that it takes a quasi-normal mode to disappear on the horizon of the black hole. Again, all of this, not precise, but parametrically for all of these models. And now what I claim is there is no large distinction, and in fact there cannot be because of our consistency conditions, between whether or not this is happening for a particle that one might have said is already inside the black hole, or a trajectory that's inside the black hole, or a trajectory that's not inside the black hole. Those two trajectories, if I think about causal diamonds, okay, here's one of them. So here's the stretched horizon. Okay, and I want to think about a trajectory whose causal diamond looks like this. Okay, and a trajectory whose causal diamond looks like this. And this is where the stretched horizon is for this system. Now, in both of those, remember their proper times are synchronized. Okay. And in both of those, there will be, in this model, a period in which this set of degrees of freedom has not yet been turned on. And that period scales like n log n in Planck units. Okay? By, again, the fast scrambling hypothesis and the explicit 1 over n, which gives the time scale for the equilibrating interactions. In terms of the trajectory that stays outside, this is precisely the behavior that we want and expect this system to exhibit, because we see in classical general relativity precisely this phenomenon of equilibration. And it's well known to general relativists that there is in that equilibration what people call, at least some people call, a mirage that gives you a picture of what's happening inside the black hole as well. To give you an example of that mirage, if I take a pair of charged particles and drop them into a black hole in different places, then what I see on the stretched horizon looked at from the outside is a dipole. That dipole evolves with time, and in a scrambling time, it closes up. And that is the image on the horizon of the two particles meeting someplace inside the horizon. And of course, if this were a Rindler horizon rather than a black hole horizon, that would be precisely what's actually going on. So the claim that we're making is that it is in this formalism possible to write down a Hamiltonian describing a trajectory that goes inside the black hole. And why is that possible? The reason that it's possible is because that trajectory with an actual physical system on it, okay, carries with it a whole set of extra degrees of freedom that are in a frozen state initially. And the dynamics unfreezes that state, and that unfreezing process takes a certain amount of time. And our claim is that since we can do this for a trajectory that one would interpret in this picture as crossing the horizon, okay, one can define that dynamics as the interior dynamics of the black hole. The overlap conditions tell you that that's completely frozen and mapped by what the external observer sees. In other words, the mirage of the external observer is the reality of the internal observer. And I believe in that case there are no real contradictions with quantum information. or any other sort of statements, because this is not quantum field theory. There are all of these extra degrees of freedom that can't be interpreted as particles and do not carry energy.
Wait a minute. I thought you explained that at least in the limit where the dimension becomes arbitrarily large, those things do carry energy out through the theory of infinity if they happen to be excited.
No. No, 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 no. These things that are zeros, those are the things that are forced to be equal to zero by the initial conditions, and we argue dynamically remain, order n of them, remain equal to zero in the final state as well. So those correspond not to this stuff out here, but to the annuli. Let me draw it more carefully. Each particle jet is surrounded by a jet isolation annulus, which says all the low momentum stuff that came out in this region is included in this smaller region here. There's no more low momentum stuff around it, and therefore I can think of these as independent degrees of freedom. Okay? Those are the things that are being turned on. Those carry exactly zero energy, even at finite end. Okay? They are analogous to the off-diagonal things in the DFSS matrix model, which also carried zero energy. That was Lycoming energy. It's a completely different story, but there's an analogy there which I think is of some interest.
So if we were in ADS, though, this wouldn't help very much, right?
Sorry?
If we were in ADS.
I do not yet have, this is a part three question. Okay. I did not.
Joe needs to find a new standard for
the questions.
I'm being very frank with you, right? And we've talked about this.
Yeah.
I have vague thoughts about how to do all of this stuff in ABS, but I don't actually have any kind of a real model yet. I've been thinking about it a lot as a consequence of being at this workshop. So. Okay. So, all right, those are the basic points that I wanted to make. We've also claimed, and this is something I would not stand behind as firmly as I stand behind the rest of it, that you can get an understanding of what's going on with the singularity from thinking about this. Because what this is really saying is that when you hit the black hole after it's been in equilibrium for a while, the interior of the black hole that you experience wasn't really there before. It has to do with degrees of freedom that are brought into the system when you approach the black hole. Okay? The interior of the black hole has to do with the fact that it takes a long time to turn these things on and to equilibrate these particles with the rest of the system. So if these particles were interacting with each other and scattering for a while, they would scatter as if the black hole wasn't there, and then they would start to feel the effect of these degrees of freedom being turned on by the Hamiltonian. Part of the singularity behavior that I believe is associated with this is the fact if you look at the geometry of the black hole singularity, there are two things going on. If you think about the usual picture of a star as a bowl, all right, then what happens when you create a black hole is the static bowl becomes dynamical here, and it becomes, quote, infinitely long and infinitely thin in finite proper time, but the region up near the top always stays with a smooth geometry of order the Schwarzschild radius. And that all that infinitely long, infinitely thin junk is always happening in a place that's causally disconnected from you. What does causally disconnected mean in quantum mechanics? It means associated with degrees of freedom that commute with you and which you have not yet interacted with. Okay? That, I think, is what we're seeing here. The reason the black hole is an approximation to the actual black hole, in which I attribute the black hole an infinite amount of entropy. Okay? The classical eternal black hole, the reason it doesn't decay is because it has an infinite amount of entropy. So that has to have this region where it's continually allowing for little tiny things that I don't allow to perturb the hydrodynamic metric in without having any effect. This is the quantum mechanics of what's really going on. They do have an effect. And we know that, in fact, even something quite small of order the Planck mass increases the entropy by an amount of order m in four dimensions. And so there is a large increase in entropy, which we usually don't talk about when we throw something small like a chair into a black hole. Okay? But it's there. In the quantum mechanics, it's important. I think the reason the hydrodynamics has this running away of the singularity is to be able to account for that. Okay? And then you can make an even less plausible sounding story about why it looks like things are squeezing together. Basically because different trajectories that are thrown in from different places, which normally would see very, very different sets of degrees of freedom if they waited a long time in Minkowski space, they end up just having a complete overlap. Not every place on the sphere, but if you're close enough together, you come in at an angle, you do get an overlap of your causal diamonds that is not what you would expect in flat space. And the geometric way that you encode that is by having this squeezing of the black hole stroke. And this last part, I really wouldn't want anybody to hold me to. First part sounds sort of plausible to me. Okay, so that's our story about black holes. Thank you for your attention.
Just one general question about the underlying Minkowski metric. Does it worry you that in the end that metric will still somehow make itself felt and you won't recover Lorentz invariance? You'll have a kind of ether that's visible. You won't recover the fact that in general relativity or physics as we know it, there's no imprint of some underlying background Minkowski metric.
Actually, probably you want to say you don't recover diff invariance.
Well, that's even a bigger, we should get that, but I'm just worried at the very basic level, do you see the mechanism by which we're assured that we won't see the fact that there's an underlying Minkowski metric in your theory governing the fundamental structure of the Hamiltonian?
The only way in which I see that is that I'm fairly convinced that if we were powerful enough, we could take the superstring perturbation theory and resum it, okay, by some resurgence technique. So basically, that's going to give us an asymptotic expansion of all scattering amplitudes at all energies, which breaks down rather dramatically in the black hole region.
Well, it's not asymptotic there.
Excuse me? Yeah, I agree. But there's a region where it's asymptotic. It gives rise to an analytic S matrix. And so if there's a way to resum it in the region where it's asymptotic, then I think we should be able to analytically continue the answer. Okay? Now that calculation of the scattering matrix is done just in a background Minkowski space. Okay? Nothing else there. in the space-time picture. Mm-hmm. All right? So I don't think that Minkowski space leaves any imprint. And what I've been trying to advocate here, I haven't talked about trajectories that are not Minkowski geodesics because it's a lot harder. I haven't even talked about two Minkowski geodesics that are in relative motion. Mm-hmm. But we have tried to talk about, for example, the Unruh trajectories, and we believe that you should be able, given a sufficiently rich set of, say, Minkowski trajectories, also view the same quantum mechanical system from a different trajectory, looking at the overlaps of its causal diamonds. So there will be that kind of general covariance built into the formalism. We claim that that's part of the axioms of our theory. We haven't implemented them on any particular model yet because we can't even do the much simpler case of relative velocity. But that should come out. If it turns out that it's impossible to satisfy those constraints, then I would say this attempt has failed.
Aren't you just sort of morally taking this sort of Weinbergian perspective of, you know, you want Lorentz invariance and you want spin 2 excitation?
No, what I'm taking is the string theory perspective. The string theory perspective is the theory of quantum gravity in Minkowski space is a Lorentz invariant S matrix that's unitary. Lorentz invariant already satisfies whatever the correct causality axioms are. We have locality sort of built in to our scattering problem.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm taking as the basis.
But I mean I think that is Weinberg's thing though. As he says, you've got a Lorentz invariant S matrix and it's got spin 2 particles in it, and then the only way for, you know, along the lines of, you know, you need gauge symmetry if you want to have spin 1 particle.
The only extent to which I agree with that philosophy is that I wouldn't expect to see a quantum theory that has general coordinate transformations on some set of quantum variables. Okay? Our version of general coordinate invariance is comparing many different quantum systems. And that, of course, gets around one of the severe problems of the standard coordinate invariant approaches when you don't have an asymptotic boundary, which is it tells you what time means.
Well, you're kind of picking a clock or something, right?
Yeah, I pick an infinite number of different clocks and compare the physics as described by those different clocks to the extent that I'm supposed to get equivalent physics.
So these jets that you talked about, if I didn't on this point, I'm very confused about. You said that we don't have particles, right?
Yes.
We have a hydrodynamic.
No. They're two different statements. Okay. So one statement is, if I look generically at Einstein's equations, please. Cookies.
I will catch you later.
Okay, sure.
Possibly not today.
Probably not today.
Okay.
So there are two different statements. One is, if I have a situation of very high entropy, then I may have solutions of Einstein's equations, which have a purely hydrodynamic character. And a description of the quantized gravitational field in those regions will not be a good description of what's going on. The second statement is, if I have a system with a ground state, then I expect to be able to quantize hydrodynamics, and that's what I believe we do in string theory, but something that does break down in our standard particle physics terminology is the concept of a single isolated particle. Because there's just, in an interacting theory of gravity, there's no way to guarantee that's what you get. They're in high enough dimension, there's some probability for that to happen, but there is also probability for that particle to come out accompanied with 15 very soft gravitons that are more or less collinear with it, and 150,000 that are going out in all sorts of directions.
But
with very low energy.
But this real emissions in processes and reprocesses, this doesn't mean that quantum field theory is breaks down or anything.
I'm not saying the quantum field theory breaks down. In fact,
the picture of single particles.
Well, you see, it does break down in the sense that if you want to describe an exactly unitary S matrix in one of these theories, you can't restrict yourself to single particle states, because there will be states with an arbitrarily large number of gravitons emitted in high dimensions with small probability. In four dimensions with probability one, you'll emit an infinite number of gravitons. That's the origin of the infrared divergences. I think the cure for that is to talk about jet amplitudes, in which I say, let's describe all possible conserved quantum numbers in the theory, and I ask how much of each of those is flowing out through the boundary within some spherical cap. I isolate them by saying there's nothing coming out in some region around that cap, and then I have to allow for the possibility that stuff came out in all possible other directions that aren't associated with those caps. And then I can try to take the limit where the size of those caps goes to zero in the area, and that'll give me, if I get something that's delta function localized in momentum space, that's a single particle state. So that's a special case of these. If you think about the actual current variables as measures on the momentum space at null infinity, then a particle is a delta function localized measure. So it's a special case of a state of this current operator, okay? And what my claim is that it's kind of artificial to try to build everything up in terms of those states rather than talking about general states in which the current operator is non-zero in some region on asymptotic momentum space. That's what I'm trying to advocate.